It's common knowledge that stress weakens our immune system. R3 Set are an amazing holistic, science-based supplement formulated to balance all three body systems that manage stress: nervous, endocrine, and immune. R3 Set takes a holistic approach to stress management and are vegan, GMO-free, caffeine-free, melatonin-free, and made in the USA. The specific ingredients, such as passion flower, chamomile, and valerian root, help support a strong immune system. I've personally tried the 14-day R3 Set trial, and honestly, it's worked wonders for me. I tried both their Calm product, which reduced any daytime nerves I had about meetings, and their Unwind product, which was perfect after a long day of writing and meeting deadlines. What's amazing about their product as well is that it's aesthetically pleasing and smells and tastes amazing. You can also head on over to their website, which is linked below, for their email program, where they teach easy tips to improve your stress response. For example, did you know that there was a science behind why petting a dog makes you feel more relaxed? If you would like to try R3 Set yourself, you can head to Target.com, which is running a special in the month of June 2020, or order them on r3set.com with a 10% discount for my listeners, which will last until 2021. Just enter promo code Morbidology when checking out. Take control of your stress today. Welcome to Morbidology, the podcast. I'm your host, Emily G. Thompson, author of Unsolved Child Murders, Cults Uncovered, and co-author of Unsolved Murders, True Crime Cases Uncovered. Join me weekly as I uncover some of the world's most heinous murders. To some, Britain seems like a utopia. Each year, thousands of people from all across the world flock to Britain in search of a better life. They all come filled with hope and anticipation of what their new life in Britain will look like. In 2000, a family from Nigeria came to Britain looking for pastures greener. Instead, however, they found themselves all too aware of just how depraved and cruel other human beings can be, and got a stark insight into the dark underbelly of urban and lawless Britain. Dami Lola Taylor was a 10-year-old boy living in the Peckham Estate in London. He was born in Nigeria and arrived in Britain with his mother, Gloria, brother, Babatunde, and sister, Bemi, in September of 2000. They had come to Britain to seek urgent medical treatment for Bemi, who suffered from extreme epilepsy and could not get the specialist care she needed in Nigeria. Damilola's father, Richard, remained behind in Nigeria, working as an official in the Defence Ministry. Richard had been a student in London for many years beforehand and was expected to make the trip over to Britain in a few months. Next, we will hear from Dami Lola's father, Richard.
He, anywhere he is, he wants to be noticed, you know. He wants, because he's doing, you know, good things, he was doing the positive things, you know, he's taking part in activities. He always relates with the elderly people, you know, those who are older than him. I think he's a very old boy, you know. I'm sure, you know, that boy is not it's not ordinary.
It had taken the family 2 years to save up the money for the big move, selling the family's two cars and borrowing money from friends and family. They had lived a comfortable life in Nigeria, with Gloria and Richard working full-time jobs to provide the very best for their children. Damilola went to a private primary school, but as Beme struggled with her epilepsy, the family knew that they needed to do something, so they moved over to Britain. While they had lived comfortably in Nigeria, it was still stuck in the third world and was held back by the endemic corruption of 40 years of almost interrupted military dictatorship.
While in Nigeria, everything was fine. School was good for the young people, but medical reasons had to make us decide on the movement back to the UK.
Once in Britain, Damilola was enrolled at Oliver Goldsmith Primary School in Peckham, London. Damilola was amazed by the modern school books, the chance to learn about science and technology, and a computer terminal, all things that were widely unavailable to children in Nigeria at the time. Damilola had only been in the school for 3 months. It was barely long enough for Damilola to have made any friends, but Damilola was slowly making friends and settling in to the school. The majority of the 600 students were from refugee or ethnic minority backgrounds. Damilola was a bright and playful child and always excelled in school, both in Nigeria and Britain. He loved drawing Pokemon characters, reading books, and watching television. Damilola also enjoyed playing football, and when he came to Britain, he brought his first pair of football boots. He supported both Liverpool and Manchester United. Damilola aspired to be a doctor so that he could find a cure for epilepsy. On the 26th of November 2000, Damilola came home from school and told his mother that he was being bullied. He confided in Gloria that he had been accused of being gay, had been mocked for his African accent, and had been beaten up. While bullying is completely abhorrent, it's something that sadly some children expect to face. However, in Nigeria, bullying in schools is virtually unheard of. It was something that hadn't even crossed Damilola's mind when he came to Britain. The following day, Gloria escorted her son to school. She confided in her neighbour that Damilola would not tell her who it was in the school that was bullying him out of fear that it would make things worse. However, after walking Damilola to school, Gloria chatted with the headmaster, Mark Parsons. Despite the fact that Damilola was being bullied, he still loved going to school. Each morning he would wake up before everybody else in the family and prepare his school books and pencil case, ready for the day ahead. His favourite subjects were English, maths and literature. Damilola had felt so safe about living in England that he had no qualms about walking to and from school on his own each day. According to headmaster Mark Parsons, however, Damilola was a little naive and not streetwise. He wouldn't have known what it meant if some boys in the school or on the estate squared up to him. Damilola was a boisterous, fun, smiling boy. If I think about him, I think of him smiling. It would be great if he was my son. He was a lovely boy, he recollected. On the 27th of November 2000, Damilola finished his day at school and then went to an after-school computer studies class at Peckham Library.
Yes, can you say the ambulance to Blake's Road?
Road.
SC15.
SC15?
Yeah, SC15, yeah. It's a boy bleeding to death. Right. It's actually bleeding to death. This boy is approximately about 12 years of age.
He has lost
a hell of a lot of blood.
Yeah. How has he done that? What happened?
We do not know, sir. We've just come out and found him on the staircase. He's tried to climb up.
Right, where is he bleeding from?
He's bleeding from? We cannot tell.
At around 4:50 p.m., a 999 call was placed to the ambulance service after a member of the public discovered Damilola barely conscious on a stairwell in an apartment block on the North Peckham estate. He was surrounded in a puddle of his own blood. The man who called 999 said to the operator, "It's a boy bleeding to death. He's actually bleeding to death." While waiting for help, the man and five members of the public desperately attempted to stop the bleeding. Anthony Elliott, one of the first men on the scene to try and help Dami Lola, said, "I didn't know who it was, or their age, creed, or colour. The first thing that caught my eye was the amount of blood on the stairwell. I then focused directly on this person's face, and to my astonishment, it was a little boy." Shortly before the paramedics arrived, Dami Lola stopped bleeding, indicating that his heart had stopped. Moments later, police arrived on the scene and attempted CPR on Dami Lola before paramedics arrived and took over. They carried out emergency treatment on the stairwell before rushing Dami Lola to King's College Hospital, but it was already much too late. Dami Lola was pronounced dead on arrival. He died with friends. He made friends that night. In a very sad way, when he died, each of us died a little bit that night as well. I personally did. I just hope wherever he is now, he is resting happy, said Anthony when he discovered that Dami Lola had passed away. Shortly before the discovery of Dami Lola, police had been called to an incident in nearby Blake's Road when a fight between a group of youths was reported. When they arrived on the scene, however, there was no sign of a fight. An autopsy concluded that Dami Lola had been stabbed once in the leg with a broken bottle, and the wound had severed his femoral artery. Investigators believe that after being attacked and stabbed on Blake's Road, Dami Lola managed to crawl 30 yards away from his attackers in a bid to reach the safety of his own home before collapsing in the first floor stairwell at the estate's Hordle Promenade walkway north. He left behind a trail of blood. Shortly after Dami Lola was discovered, his mother, who was unaware of the tragedy, was scouring the estate looking for Dami Lola after he failed to return home from school. She made her way to the school, where she was informed that Dami Lola had left at regular time to go to his after-school class. As Gloria was walking back towards the estate, she met police who informed her that a child had been stabbed. They described Dami Lola and then rushed Gloria to hospital. "I saw him lying there, lying down and bleeding all over the place from his leg. He was such a lovely, playful boy and made friends so easily, even with younger ones," she recollected. The crime scene was cordoned off while forensic investigators searched the surrounding area. They discovered a broken bottle, which was examined and determined to have been the murder weapon. Traces of Dami Lola's blood was discovered on the bottle. More than 40 investigators were assigned to work on the case, which was the biggest murder hunt in London since the murder of Jill Dando. Investigators soon announced that they were looking for three black youths aged between 11 and 15. They were wearing dark hoodies when they were seen at the foot of the stairwell where Dami Lola was murdered, and later spotted running away from the scene. Investigators asked anybody who may potentially have information about the three youths or information about Dami Lola's murder to please come forward and call either the police or Crime Stoppers. "This is a tragic and appalling incident. Our sympathies go to Dami Lola's friends and family. Until we know exactly what happened, we will put out additional patrols in the area, and we want to reassure people we are doing everything we can." Early on in the investigation, many speculated the bullying was a possible motive behind the murder. Just the day before, Dami Lola had complained about being bullied in school. According to locals, Oliver Goldsmith Primary School was notorious for bullying, both within the schools and outside the school. Nearby Warwick Park School were known to pick on pupils from Oliver Goldsmith. According to Marion Flynn, who lived nearby, "Warwick Park kids come here to pick on the kids. They're out of control, 13-year-olds mugging 10-year-olds. They're stopping the kids on the street, taking mobile phones, school bags, and Pokemon cards." Investigators believed that maybe the three boys who had attacked Dami Lola had been excluded from school and had chased Dami Lola from a location to Blake's Road where the attack happened. One possibility, they announced, was that they had been targeting younger children leaving the primary school, bullying them and robbing them. Headmaster Mark Parsons, however, was sceptical that Dami Lola's murder had anything to do with bullies within the school. He spoke to BBC and said, "I am totally convinced it is something outside the school. The allegations of bullying related to name-calling and slight scuffles. It was not the type of bullying that would lead to this type of violence." The murder sent shockwaves all across Britain. For anybody to die like that, it's completely horrific. But it was unfathomable that a 10-year-old innocent boy could be the victim of such a senseless attack and then be left to bleed alone on an apartment stairwell. The boy was so small to die. He seemed to be by himself as the medics tried to help him. There were no friends around, recollected neighbour Alan Cabia. Peckham Estate had a notorious reputation as an area rife with drug abuse, muggings and burglaries, particularly in the 1980s. In fact, there was a time when postal workers would not deliver on the estate. However, since then, mass efforts had been made to clean the area up, and since 1995, millions had been spent on regenerating Peckham. Crime had fallen, and even some of the most crime-riddled apartment blocks had been pulled down and replaced by new apartment blocks with names like Peckham Village. The shocking murder made many locals worry that violence and crime was on the upturn once again, and police tried to counter the growing perception that North Peckham was a lawless place where gangs rule the streets. Next, we will hear from Harriet Harman, MP for Peckham at the time.
Well, I felt in two minds about it, because on the one hand, you don't want the area that people are living in to be known to become a byword for such a terrible crime involving the death of such a young boy. But on the other hand, you wouldn't want to feel that a young boy had been killed and nobody cared about it. The stain that came over Peckham because of that was quite hard for people to bear.
Just the year before the murder, London saw the largest rise in violent crime since the mid-1990s. There had been a total of 156,880 attacks, including 180 murders and 2,270 rapes. Each week, Londoners were hearing of numerous attacks perpetrated by gangs of youths. There was a new breed of young criminals, some as young as 10, who were committing crimes, mainly robberies, because they believed that it would give them street cred. According to Sir John Stevens, Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police, the recent crimes perpetrated by youths were a new phenomenon of playground bullies taking their intimidation and menace outside of school. In fact, recent studies from the West London Borough of Hounslow showed that 70% of robberies were committed by youths under the age of 17. 72% of the victims were also under 17, and 40% of the offenders had never been in trouble with police before. The following day, Gloria pleaded for more information. "He is just an innocent child. Please, anybody who can help, just come forward. He has just come to this country." The family had come to Britain for a better life, and now Dami Lola was dead and had been killed in the most heinous way ever. "Now, I wish we had never come," said Gloria. Shortly after Gloria pleaded for information, it was revealed that Dami Lola had scribbled down the name of his bullies and left the note in his school locker. Investigators announced that they would be interviewing the pupils who were named by Dami Lola. Meanwhile, a £50,000 reward was offered for information that could lead to the conviction of his killers. Althea Smith, head of the local police consultative group, urged the families of the boys who murdered Dami Lola to hand them in. "Someone is shielding people who came home bloodstained. I appeal to the parents, sisters and brothers to give those persons up or speak to police. I have a 12-year-old son myself. It could have been my child. It could have been anyone's child." Shortly thereafter, investigators received a tip from somebody who saw three children marching a smaller child along the street near where Dami Lola was murdered. They had the smaller child in a headlock. The witness said that she thought the children were messing around, but when she heard about Dami Lola's murder, she contacted police. It would be determined that the boy in the headlock wasn't Dami Lola. However, another witness soon came forward to say that she saw Dami Lola walking alone into an alley leading to the Blakes Road minutes before he was attacked. She saw Dami Lula at 4:45 p.m., only 4 minutes before the ambulance received an emergency call. Investigators now believe that Dami Lula was followed as he made his way home from school. Dami Lula's father, Richard, flew over to London. Upon his arrival, he visited the stairwell where his son died.
So I got here and the scene was so disturbing. You know, what I came to meet here was a lot of media coverage, a lot of sympathizers, you know, something that I couldn't cope with. So I just decided that I want to be left alone, you know, that I should just get grips of what really happened and what the police are doing. I was reassured that everything will be done, you know, to make sure they get hold of, they arrest the culprits and, you know, get justice done.
The stairwell had become a makeshift memorial for Dami Lula. One note was left by one of the workers who had desperately attempted to save Dami Lula's life as the paramedics were en route. It read, "Sorry I could not help you in life, but your soul will be in my heart forever." Later, Richard spoke with the media. "I cannot tell you how aggrieved I am at the sad loss of Dami Lula, my last son and child. His mother wanted him, and he took 10 years to come, and he gave us only 10 years of happiness." On the 2nd of December, two youths and a woman were arrested in connection with Dami Lula's murder. Investigators refused to share any information, but 12 hours later, they were all released on police bail. Afterwards, investigators released CCTV footage showing the last moments of Dami Lula's life. It showed Dami Lula as he left school and showed him jumping happily from stone to stone outside the Peckham Sports Centre. It showed him running into the library for an after-school computer club, and then just over an hour later, he was attacked. Investigators released the footage in the hopes that it would jog potential witnesses' memories. Dami Lula's last moments on Earth were particularly poignant. There was something so innocent about a little boy spending his last hour on Earth attempting to better himself by attending an after-school class that was not required of him or requested of him. Dami Lula had decided to attend the class on his own accord. 2 days later, a memorial for Dami Lula was held in Peckham Methodist Church. Hundreds of people packed into the church to mourn and plead that his death was not in vain. Reverend Wesley Daniel said, "The majority of people who live in Peckham do so because they enjoy living here. Despite the death of Dami Lula, this is not a haven for criminal activity. We hope that the outrage and sorrow expressed by politicians will not be words at a convenient moment, but a springboard to improve the quality of life in Peckham when the headlines have ceased." On the 7th of December, another memorial was held to celebrate what would have been Dami Lula's 11th birthday. Over 1,000 people packed into the Nigerian Pentecostal Church in Peckham and sang a number of Dami Lula's favourite hymns. During the service, his older brother apologised for not being there to protect him. "Apparently, the only thing I did not offer him was protection from his killers on that fateful day. Dami Lula, I know you are resting peacefully. Please forgive me for not being there with you," he said.
"My life can never be the same without you again. I have always wanted a brother to be there with me, that I could ask a question and he could ask questions from me too. Share each other's things. And above all, someone I can proudly call my brother."
Dami Lula was a regular at the church's Sunday school, and the family attended service several days a week. Each year, Dami Lula's parents would make a big fuss of him on his birthday. This year, they had purchased him a new Bible, which he had asked for, and biscuits and chocolate for him to take into school and share with his classmates. This was something of a tradition for children in Nigeria, and Dami Lula wanted to share both his culture and his birthday treats. In mid-December, it was revealed that 11 boys were arrested in connection with the murder of Dami Lula, as more than 200 police officers staged a series of dramatic dawn raids. The boys included the two boys who were previously arrested, all of the boys were aged between 12 and 16. The following day, most of the boys were released, but four boys remained in custody. The boys were all believed to be part of a gang from North Peckham, and none of them were classmates of Dami Lula. Investigators had received information that the boys had all been congregating around the area of Blake's Road, where Dami Lula was attacked. As Christmas was fast approaching, it was announced that another youth had been arrested. A 15-year-old boy was arrested at an address in Camberwell. While in police custody, the boy headbutted an officer and then defiantly asked, "What are you going to do about that?" The following day, he was released on bail. Investigators subsequently held a press conference at Scotland Yard. They announced that a witness made a phone call to Crime Stoppers but left no contact details, and they were wanting to identify them. They had informed Crime Stoppers that they had seen two black boys arguing with Dami Lula. A third boy was called over by the two other boys. Investigators believed that these boys could be connected to the murder since three youths were seen fleeing from the scene. The following day, investigators announced that they believed that they knew who had killed Dami Lula, but had yet to find enough evidence. They were cautious about saying how many youths they believed were involved in the attack. By this point, all of the youths that had been arrested had been bailed, except for one. Meanwhile, a 30-foot picture of Dami Lula, along with information about his murder, was projected to a nightclub near where he was killed. It was the first time that such a method to generate information had been used in London. Christmas came and went with no new information. It was a particularly heartbreaking time for Dami Lula's family. Since his siblings were in their 20s, Dami Lula was the only child in the family, and Christmas was always a special time for him. The new year brought new updates in the case when it was announced in early January the two boys, ages 13 and 14, were arrested in connection with Dami Lula's murder. The following day, however, they were released on police bail. On the 17th of January, Dami Lula was laid to rest. Around 300 people attended the funeral at the All Saints Church in southeast London. As Dami Lula's casket was carried into the church, tears flowed throughout the mourners. Dami Lula's family had considered flying him back to Nigeria for his funeral and burial, but then decided that he should be buried in Britain as a reminder of the tragedy. They want his death to remain a constant reminder of what is happening, not only within the black community, but in Britain as a whole, said a family spokesman. Shortly after the funeral, Dami Lula's case was featured on Crime Watch. During the segment, Gloria described how blood poured from Dami Lula's mouth as she embraced his body after death. They urged witnesses to please come forward in a bid to catch their son's killer. Richard said, "I don't think he deserved such an action. There was no one to come to his assistance. He had to bleed to death in a lonely stairwell." Following the emotional appeal, a number of tips were called in to the Crime Watch hotline. Two tips that were very similar came in, and the callers claimed that family members were well aware of the involvement of a number of people in their family group. Hero Cosmetics are one of today's sponsors, and they sent me over the Mighty Patch, which is an acne patch that gently pulls out pimple gunk and helps the blemish heal faster. Over the years, I've used a lot of harsh acne and skin products that have ended up irritating my sensitive skin. Furthermore, none of them ever really work at eliminating spots, so I was dead excited to try this product. Being cooped up at home, my skin has suffered, so before I went to bed, I placed the Mighty Patch on a spot and peeled it off in the morning. It's a little bit gross, but it's also satisfying to see the gunk that is absorbed on the patch. It literally made my spot vanish overnight, which is completely insane to me. No longer will I have to panic about a massive spot when I have important places to be. If you'd like to try the Mighty Patch for yourself, use code MORBIDOLOGY15 on Hero Cosmetics to save 15% on your first purchase and see the magic for yourself. Payoff.com is a paying sponsor of this episode of Morbidology. You've tried balance transfers and budgeting, but high interest rates and unrelenting bill cycles make it almost impossible to get out of credit card debt on your own. Instead of another new savings technique, you need a clear path out of debt. And that's what a payoff loan can do. A payoff loan is a personal loan backed by member-centric credit unions designed to help you pay off your credit cards. With rates as low as 5.99% APR and loan amounts up to $35,000 with no hidden fees and personal customer service support from Payoff to help you reach your financial goals. Some of the benefits of a payoff loan may also include potential credit score boost, one monthly payment, and savings from lower interest rates. Go to payoff.com/morbidology to learn more. Checking loan rates won't affect your credit score. Try something new. Pay off your credit card debt with Payoff. NMLS ID 1396805. Not all applicants may qualify. Loans only available within the United States. Loan is not available in all states. Payoff works with lending partners who originate the loans. Additional terms, conditions, and eligibility requirements may apply. More information is available at payoff.com/morbidology. In May, Lord Harris of Peckham, the head of Carpet Rite, made a £2 million donation towards a new school that would be built in Peckham in memory of Dami Lola. Shortly afterwards, it was revealed that the newspaper, The People, had interviewed a number of the boys who had been arrested and bailed. The boys had not been publicly identified due to their young ages. However, The People identified them all as members of the Young Peckham Boys Club. They were part of a growing subclass of inner-city youths who came from broken homes and existed outside of normal moral boundaries. Before May came to an end, it was announced that investigators would be sending a file to the Director of Public Prosecutions naming four youths that they believed to be involved in Dami Lola's murder. The boys weren't publicly identified, but they were aged between 14 and 16. Finally, towards the end of June, four teenage boys were arrested in connection with Dami Lola's murder. All of the boys had previously been arrested in connection with the murder. The following day, they appeared in court for a hearing during which no pleas were entered. Three of the boys, one who had a puzzle book, sat watching impassively, while the fourth, who stood at less than 5 feet tall, spent most of the hearing yawning. The arrests came as a welcome relief to Dami Lola's parents.
Well, we sighed a breath of pleasure, you know, that at last something is, they are making a breakthrough. At least if we are able to get conviction, you know, and see the case through, you know, we'll be very happy to, you know, carry on with that.
In August, the four boys were ordered to stand trial. During their court hearing, they all pleaded not guilty, and the trial was scheduled for January. As the one-year anniversary to Dami Lola's murder rolled around, tributes for the young boy were held. Prime Minister Tony Blair held a private meeting with Dami Lola's parents and officially rededicated a youth centre in the name of Dami Lola. Richard unveiled a bronze plaque depicting his son at a ceremony inside the centre. It was previously the Warwick Park Centre, but had undergone a massive refurbishment to memorialise Dami Lola. The plaque included an inscription that was found on a drawing Dami Lola had made shortly before his death. It read, "I will travel far and wide to choose my destiny and remould the world. I know it is my destiny to defend the world, which I hope to achieve during my lifetime." In early January, as the trial was approaching, it was announced that the four accused teenagers would be allowed to sit in the main part of the courtroom with a family member or social worker, as opposed to sitting in the dock. Law chiefs had wanted to avoid the criticism that followed the trial of 11-year-olds Robert Thompson and John Venables for the murder of James Bulger. The European Court of Human Rights had ruled that they were denied a fair trial in Preston in 1993. The trial began towards the end of January. During opening statements, prosecutor Mark Dennis described how Dami Lola was the victim of a deliberate and controlled act of violence after becoming the victim to a gang of youth robbers. After being stabbed with a broken bottle, Dami Lola was left crying for help, while the attackers showed no concern. Prosecutor Dennis told the jury that Dami Lola was confronted by the youths as he was making his way home. Perhaps initially attracted by the distinctive silver-coloured jacket which Dami Lola was wearing, the boys accosted him as he walked along the pavement. He was stopped, surrounded, and trapped, he said. According to the prosecutor, Dami Lola had nothing of value, and that was possibly why the events escalated. He described how one of the boys grabbed a beer bottle that had been discarded nearby. He then handed it to another one of the boys, and within moments, Dami Lola was stabbed in the left thigh, just above his knee, as he remained trapped and helpless. The bottle was then twisted in Dami Lola's leg, leaving a deep and gaping wound, which severed a major artery and vein, causing immediate and profuse bleeding. The response of the four boys was simply to run away, leaving Dami Lola pleading for help on the ground. Dami Lola then made a desperate bid to get help. He staggered or crawled around 30 yards away to the stairwell of a block of flats. He collapsed less than 200 yards from his own front door. Prosecutor Dennis revealed that a 14-year-old girl had witnessed the attack. She allegedly knew three of the attackers and had seen the fourth around the area. In due course, she was to have the courage to contact the police and thereafter come forward as a witness to the event, and now to give evidence before the court, said the prosecutor. According to the teenage girl, she had saw the four boys running into Blake's Road. She was curious to see why they were in a hurry, and by the time she reached them, they had surrounded Dami Lola. She allegedly saw one of the boys smash a bottle, then hand it to another member of the group. However, she claimed that she didn't see who actually inflicted the fatal wound.
This 14-year-old girl gave them some real key evidence and gave them some direct evidence. And by direct evidence, I mean she actually saw offenders. So it wasn't something that she'd heard. She was told by somebody else. She actually says, I saw the offenders commit this act and I saw them run away. And at that point, she gave a number of names to the police. And it was those names that the police then started to act upon.
According to a number of witnesses, the four teenagers had boasted about killing Dami Lola. One of the defendants allegedly said, people have been stabbed for less, and joked about the attack. Another defendant was said to have described how a marble had been placed in Dami Lola's mouth as he started crying out in pain after the stabbing. In fact, a marble had been found inside Dami Lola's mouth during his autopsy, yet this wasn't documented in the media. It was believed that this marble had stopped paramedics from resuscitating Dami Lola. These chilling descriptions of Dami Lola's death were given by some of the defendants while they were on remand. They had confessed that Dami Lola was stabbed because he had no money on him and refused to give the boys his coat. Bill Castle, a carpenter who was working nearby, described how he followed a trail of blood to find Dami Lola. He was one of the first citizens to arrive at the scene, and by this point, Dami Lola was still conscious. On the witness stand, Bill tearfully described how he climbed up the stairs and discovered Dami Lola, saturated in blood, struggling to climb up the stairs ahead of him. Bill rushed up the stairs to find Dami Lola, who fell onto him. Bill grabbed Dami Lola before he fell to the floor and cradled him. He described how Dami Lola's last words were, I'm okay, I'm okay, before he started to fall into unconsciousness. Bill called 999 on his mobile phone while screaming for help from other passerbys. Prosecutor Dennis said that the words from Dami Lola were indicative of a brave young boy who was evidently far from okay. According to Bill, as he was holding Dami Lola, he saw three youths on the road below him, and one made a deliberate gesture with his hand across the top of his leg. The gesture closely paralleled the injury inflicted on Dami Lola. During Bill's testimony, he found it difficult to keep his composure and kept saying, he was just a little boy. When the four boys were arrested, they tried to blame two other youngsters for the killing. When one of the boys was arrested, he was discovered hiding behind his bed, while a poem was discovered in the bedroom of one of the other boys, which read, "I went mad when I heard he was 10, but never fuck around with the..." The last word was redacted, but I speculate that it said, "Never fuck around with the Young Peckham Boys Club." On the second day of the trial, a poignant video was showed which depicted Dami Lola's last moments on Earth. The film had come from security cameras at the public library where Dami Lola was attending an after-school computer class. The video showed Dami Lola playing in the library with an 11-year-old friend. CCTV footage then captured Dami Lola playing tag with his friend and his friend's sister in the street. In fact, this friend was John Boyega, who played Finn in the Star Wars sequel films. The final images showed Dami Lola heading home alone down the street outside the library. The footage showed the simple innocence of a child, but just minutes later, Dami Lola would be fighting for his life. PC James Greenhill also testified about desperately attempting to resuscitate Dami Lola. During his testimony, a number of people in court, including jurors, began to weep. He described how he had performed CPR but could not get air into Dami Lola's lungs. He described the scene. Dami Lola was lying on the top of the flight of stairs and there was a group of workmen standing near him. I pushed my way to get to the boy and knelt down beside him, putting my ear to his mouth to see whether or not he was breathing. I gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and tried to fill his lungs with oxygen, but I was unable to do so. I satisfied myself I had cleared the tongue and did mouth-to-mouth again, and it went a little bit more successfully. I got a few breaths into his lungs, but I wasn't able to resuscitate him, he said. He told the jury that his colleague tended to Dami Lola's leg while he searched his body for other stab wounds. When he put his finger to Dami Lola's throat to search for a pulse, there wasn't one. The most pivotal moment of the trial came when the teenage girl testified that she had witnessed the attack on Dami Lola. She was 14 years old when she was walking home and saw the four defendants turning into Blake's Road. By the time she followed them around the corner, they had surrounded Dami Lola. She described how she hid behind the car and watched as one of the boys picked up a bottle and smashed it. He walked to the boys and they was passing around this bottle. Someone was saying something to this little boy and they hit him with the thing, she said. She described how one of them, she wasn't sure which one, then put their hands near his face. She couldn't see clearly, but she saw the boy on the ground crying for help, but she said she didn't want to go near him because she didn't want to get in trouble. She also admitted that she had falsely claimed she had bet the two boys £10 that they were not the killers of Dami Lola. When Prosecutor Dennis asked if she was telling the whole truth today, she said yes. Courtney Griffiths, who was the defense lawyer for one of the boys, accused the young girl of lying, to which she replied that she was not lying. She told defense Griffiths, "I'm not answering you. I don't like the way you're talking to me. You're talking to me like I'm a little girl." She then began answering questions by simply saying, "I can't remember," in a sarcastic sing-song voice. When asked about the description of the boys attacking Dami Lola, she replied, "I haven't got a picture in front of me." Then when defense Griffiths said that was why they were relying on her memory, she responded with, "You can't rely on that." The girl admitted that she told several lies in her initial phone call to police, including that two of the defendants had phoned her to say that they were responsible. Defense Griffiths said, "This was just your imagination." To which the girl replied, "It's not my imagination, it's your fucking imagination." She then declared, "You know what, I'm going home," and stormed out of the courtroom. Following her dramatic testimony, a teacher testified that the girl had told them that she was being given a free holiday by police. The teacher had been acting as the girl's legal guardian during questioning by two female police officers, and the conversation was caught on tape. The girl also said, "I don't get none of this money until I'm 18, she said, referring to the reward fund. In another video, she demanded, "Just give me the £50,000 before bursting out laughing and saying, "Gimme, gimme, gimme." The teacher replied, "The rate you're going, I doubt your evidence will be any use at all to get any reward." To which she replied, "Yeah, they still gotta give me some money for wasting my time." The girl later changed her story after police said she would be more guaranteed to get the reward fund if she had actually witnessed the attack. When pressed as to why she had told several versions of events to police, she exclaimed, "How am I supposed to remember all of the lies I've told?" The girl then took the stand once again to deny she made up the story for the reward fund, stating, "I don't need the money, I've got enough money." She admitted to changing her story, but claimed she didn't change it because she was informed she had a better chance of receiving the money if she had actually witnessed the murder. It would next be revealed that the girl and her mother had racked up a £4,000 hotel bill in 1 week after she was placed in a witness protection program. Under cross-examination, she denied that she had learned details of the case from newspapers. A number of terms she had used to describe the murder, such as blood flowing like a water fountain, had been used in a number of newspaper articles. The girl responded by saying that she couldn't read. The girl's school records were presented and showed that she had been asked to move schools and had been accused of dishonesty and violent and disruptive behaviour. She denied the claims that she was an attention seeker. Following her testimony, one of the defence lawyers accused police of manufacturing a witness because they could not afford another unsolved black death. They said that police took advantage of a young girl in the wake of criticism over the police's handling of the murder of Stephen Lawrence, a black teenager who was killed in a racial attack. Defence Griffiths cross-examined Police Sergeant Carolyn Crooks and questioned whether she got the impression that the witness was taking them for a ride, to which she replied, "No." It was then revealed that phone records of two of the defendants placed them 2 miles away from the crime scene just minutes after Dami Lola was stabbed. Police knew this, yet failed to mention it while questioning the young girl who had named them as the killers. According to Defence Griffiths, unless they were beamed across in Star Trek, they couldn't have got from Peckham to Abbey Street in a couple of minutes. When the police got hold of that information, why didn't you back and interview the girl and confront her? You were anxious to place before a jury a witness of truth. The detective in charge of the investigation, Detective Superintendent Trevor Shepherd, admitted to the jury that dropping the case against the suspects would have damaged the reputation of the police. He said that he submitted the file in the case to the Crown Prosecution Service before he had even charged the four boys. However, he denied the defence's suggestion that politics of race had played a part in his decision-making process. However, Defence Griffiths refuted this and referred DCI Shepherd to his police logs where he had written, "The public profile of the investigation is such that a discontinuance would severely damage the reputation of the Metropolitan Police and the police in general." Pathologist Dr. Vesna Javorek testified in regards to Dami Lola's injury. Graphic photographs were shown in court as the pathologist described how Dami Lola had been stabbed with a broken bottle. It was then twisted into his thigh, severing an artery and causing massive blood loss. The position of the cut suggested that Dami Lola may have been lying on the floor with his killer leaning over him. Under cross-examination, Defence Griffiths said that one expert had suggested that the injury could have been caused by Dami Lola falling on a shard of glass. However, the pathologist vigorously rejected this claim. Following the testimony of the pathologist, the judge made the shocking decision to throw out the evidence of the teenage girl who had claimed she witnessed the murder. Mr. Justice Hooper said that no reasonable jury could be sure that her account of what she had seen was reliable. Following this, he ordered the acquittal of one of the teenagers, and the trial continued for the other three. Following this, testimony detailed the defendant's interviews with police. One of the boys had repeatedly taunted a policewoman with the words, "Prove I was there," and "No comment." He had also made a gun symbol with his hands and told the officer, "Boom." Another defendant had told the same officer, "I'm going to have you when I get out of here." We will refer to these two defendants as Boy A and Boy B. The two boys were brothers, and boy A broke down in tears when he was asked by investigators if he would grass up his brother and when told about the heartbreak of Dami Lola's parents. According to a prison officer, the brothers had admitted to stabbing Dami Lola in the leg and laughed that it wasn't their fault that he had bled to death. According to Defence Griffiths, the boys had said that to appear tough and to prevent bullies picking on them. An inmate also testified that one of the brothers had confessed to killing Dami Lola because he was getting too lippy, and when he asked if he regretted it, he said no, and that he would do the same thing again. According to the inmate, the other brother said that he witnessed the murder but didn't do anything. He added that there were five boys involved, and one who did the stabbing. Under cross-examination, the defence team provided records to show that he was not in the same prison wing as the two brothers. This led Mr. Justice Hopper to comment that he was not happy with the evidence. Shortly thereafter, the other defendant, not either of the brothers, was formally cleared of the murder by the judge. Following the acquittal, Defence Griffiths said that the phone record evidence that placed the brothers almost 2 miles away blew apart the case against the pair. If the two brothers were involved in Dami Lola's murder, they would have had to have run a 4-minute mile to use their mobile phones after the murder. After all of the evidence was presented, the jury were sent off to deliberate. After 4 days of deliberation, the jury unanimously acquitted the two brothers, who were the two remaining defendants of Dami Lola's murder. As the boys walked free, the focus turned to the police investigation and the prosecution's case. The murder of Dami Lola was one of the biggest Metropolitan Police murder inquiries of recent times and had cost £2.8 million. The failure to secure a conviction was an embarrassment for both the police and the Crown Prosecution Service. Following the fierce criticism, 2 reviews of the handling of the case were ordered. A report by Sir David Calvert-Smith, Director of Public Prosecutions, found that police failed to allocate enough detectives to the inquiry and then bungled its attempts to convict the 4 teenagers of the murder. The report declared that the murder squads were understrength by up to 600 officers, which meant that the police and the Crown Prosecution Service prepared poorly for the trial. While many believed that this was the tragic end of a tragic case, police didn't give up on Dami Lola. Following the acquittals, they continued in their investigation, and then in January of 2005, it was announced that 3 suspects had been arrested in connection with Dami Lola's murder.
All I can say at the moment is that 3 people this morning were arrested in connection with Dami Lola Taylor's murder. They're being held in a police station in South London. I think what people need to understand is, in relation to inquiries such as this, we, the Metropolitan Police, never give up.
It was revealed that the 3 who'd been arrested were among the first youths to have been arrested early on in the investigation. It was also revealed that a breakthrough in DNA technology had led to the arrests. The 3 new suspects weren't initially identified, but would later be identified as Danny Preddy, who was 12 years old at the time of Dami Lola's murder, his brother Ricky Preddy, who was 13 years old at the time of the murder, and Hassan Jihad, who was 14 years old at the time of the murder. The following day, all 3 were charged with the murder of Dami Lola. During the trial, it was alleged that the 3 had picked out Dami Lola to mug due to his distinctive silver puffer jacket. It was also revealed that as forensic science had advanced, investigators went back to re-examine all of the evidence in the case. Blood and fibres were recovered from items of clothing and shoes from the 3 defendants, and the blood was found to be Dami Lola's. The prosecution described how all of the defendants had difficult upbringings. Danny, the younger brother, had been in a children's home under local authority care at the time of the murder. There was little to no discipline at the home, and it was far from secure. Ricky was a day pupil at a nearby assessment centre, but failed to attend on the day that Dami Lola was killed. Hassan lived with his aunt and was attending a learning centre. Prosecutor Victor Temple went on to describe how the blood evidence was somehow missed in the initial investigation. Hassan had admitted that he was on the street where Dami Lola was attacked, but all 3 said that they weren't involved. Prosecutor Temple said that a drop of Dami Lula's blood and a fibre identical to those on his trousers were discovered on Danny's shoe, and tests suggested that the blood fell onto the shoe from above. Red fibres from Dami Lula's jumper were found on Danny's jacket, and his blood was found on Ricky's sweatshirt cuff. A fibre from Dami Lula's sweatshirt was found on Hassan's jogging bottoms. Prosecutor Temple said that the scientific evidence was a massive breakthrough and the most crucial part of the trial. When the boys were picked up by police and questioned early on in the investigation, it was noticed that Ricky had cuts to his hands which could have been caused by broken glass. The same witnesses from the first trial testified once again. However, there were additional witnesses. A number of people testified that the brothers had confessed to the murder, but all of the witnesses believed that they were only confessing to make themselves appear tough. The most pivotal moment, however, was when the forensic evidence was presented. Owen Gale, a forensic science supervisor, took to the stand to admit that he missed the blood evidence on the suspect's clothing. The blood was discovered years later using a luminol test. He told the jury he had not used the luminol test because it was not standard procedure within the Forensic Science Service at the time. After 4 days of deliberation, the jury found Hassan not guilty of Dami Lula's murder. The jurors were still deliberating on the verdicts of Danny and Ricky. Then the following day, they too were cleared of the murder, but jurors failed to agree on a verdict of manslaughter. It was then announced that a retrial would be held. The third murder trial began in June of 2006. Once again, the blood evidence against the brothers was presented, and finally, they were convicted of manslaughter. After the murder, they had bragged about being untouchable, and as the verdict was read, Ricky began swearing and threatening police. The evidence against the two brothers was overwhelming. There was no way Dami Lula's blood could have gotten on their shoes or clothing unless they were there at the scene. The verdict was a welcome relief to Dami Lula's family. Outside of court, they said, "No verdict can return our son to us, but it's a great comfort. Justice has finally been done for Dami Lula. We pray that his gentle soul can rest in peace." The three trials had cost a whopping £16 million. Ricky and Danny were subsequently sentenced to just 8 years. However, due to the time they had already spent in custody, they could apply for parole in just 3 years. The verdict was a slap in the face. In September of 2010, Ricky was released, and then the following year, Danny was released. In March of 2011, Ricky was re-arrested for breaching terms of his release. One of his release conditions was that he did not enter Peckham. However, Ricky had been associating with gang members in Peckham. He was released again in January of 2012, and just 16 days later, he was rearrested for associating with gang members in Peckham once again. He was released in July of 2012 before being arrested once again in December of 2013 after stealing a motorbike and leading police on a high-speed chase. He was jailed for 5 months, and then in November of 2017, he was jailed for 6 weeks for driving offences. In February of 2020, he was jailed for 4 years for running over a female police officer. The only positive thing about this entire case is that Dami Lula's murder was not in vain, and out of the agony came hope for the future. In the immediate aftermath, millions of pounds were poured into Peckham Estate, and a number of the grim tower blocks were ripped down and replaced with brightly coloured townhouses. The tower block where Dami Lula took his final breath was torn down, and in its place a garden was planted. As for the youths of the area who once roamed the streets, more after-school homework clubs and community projects were put in place, as well as the Dami Lula Taylor Youth Centre. State funding was provided to improve the housing stock and renovate the streets. Other measures included improved lighting, cleaning, security guards, and a zero-tolerance policy by police. Dami Lula's parents embarked on a tireless fight for justice that was a credit to Dami Lula's name.
Having read and saw what the situation in Peckham was with young people and the story behind the young people that had formed themselves into gangs, young people being taken away from parents, you know, by the social services and ending up in secured homes. Those stories were stories that made me to think that a lot has to be done, you know.
In the aftermath, they worked with anti-bullying and anti-knife charities and established the Dami Lula Taylor Trust Fund, which focuses on young people's needs by implementing programs and activities for youths.
I mean, some people you see, they campaign for the death penalty, they campaign for more draconian laws, but Richard Taylor argued that young people who get involved in crime are themselves victims of terrible upbringing, and if support can be given to them, then that can make their lives better as well as protect people who otherwise might be victims of their crime. So I think it was a very remarkable approach he took, really.
Sadly, in 2008, Gloria passed away, but through Richard's continued activism, she and Dami Lula live on. As Richard said, "Dami Lula never got to realise his dream, but I know that he would be proud of his legacy."
If I am in a position for the rest of my life, those young people, to, you know, give them the opportunity which Dami Lula has been deprived of, you know, what Dami Lula cannot achieve, they can, you know, achieve through our help. Oh, well, you know, the young man will be watching wherever he is, you know, that this has been his wish, you know, because from the poem he wrote that he was going to change the world, that it is his wish to change the world, and he will want to do it in his lifetime. Well, maybe this is the form of change he wanted to bring into the world, but he wasn't going to physically do it. You know, he has come, laid his life for it to be used, you know, for people to achieve. For me, I think he will be there watching and be happy that his wish has been met.
Dami Lula Taylor had come to Britain from Nigeria, full of optimism and hope, only to end up dying alone in a dingy stairwell in a dodgy estate. According to Ditch the Label, 1/5 of young people in Britain are bullied. Sadly, over the years, what has changed is the violence of the bullying with the introduction of weapons. The tragic waste of such a young and talented life at the hands of killers who were not much older than their victim, came to symbolise the moral decay and lawlessness plaguing inner-city Britain. The murder of a child by another child sends shockwaves throughout society, and what's so poignant about this case is that Dami Lula and his family came to Britain in search of greener pastures, but instead, they were thrust into every family's worst nightmare. Well, guys, that is it for this episode of Morbidology. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'd like to take a second to say a massive thank you to my new Patreon supporters, Rebecca Manners, Jesse Wilson, Rebecca Hutton, Marissa Bean, and Laura Yarnell. I am eternally grateful for your support. If you'd like to support the show in return for exclusive episodes of Morbidology Plus, early release episodes, ad-free episodes, and of course, the most important, my undying love, then please check Morbidology out on Patreon or Himalaya Plus. I've included the links in the show notes. Can I also ask that if you enjoy Morbidology, please consider voting for Morbidology for the Listener's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. I've included a link in the show notes, and it's as easy as just typing Morbidology in the search bar. Massive thank you to everybody who has listened to an episode, commented on an episode, shared an episode with your friends. All the support is so much appreciated. Also, make sure you visit us at morbidology.com for more information about this episode and to read our true crime articles. And stay tuned to the end of this episode to hear a promo for the amazing true crime podcast, Murder in the Rain. Until next time, take care of yourselves. Stay safe and have an amazing week.
Hold up. Calling all true crime fans, murderinos, crime junkies, and wine coven members. Have you listened to Murder in the Rain yet?
Murder in the Rain is a true crime podcast based in the Pacific Northwest, focused on the local cases that make us the notorious home of bizarre crimes and serial killers.
I'm your host, Alicia Holland.
And I'm your host, Emily Rowney.
Josh, I forgot.
In each episode, we will cover a case to bring you all the details of the crime. We often feature interviews with people close to the cases, including authors, victims, doctors, and detectives.
Most content is dark and not suitable for young or sensitive listeners, but we do try to lighten the mood by providing a blooper reel at the end of every single episode. Trust me, you'll love it.
Check us out today, and if you like us, don't forget to subscribe, follow us on social media, and leave us a review.
Our website, murderintherain.com, has additional content, podcast feeds, discount codes to some of our sponsors, and an interactive map with locations for each episode.